Thank you, son. Thank you so much, Jeannie. Hi, y'all. I am an alcoholic. My name is Ashley. So
Ashley.
delighted the Grace Group is hosting me tonight. I really appreciate your willingness and your trust and allowing me to visit with you this evening. I am indeed at an airport, the Boston airport, on my way to a funeral. I can pretend to care, but I can't pretend to show up. And as my sponsor taught me, yes, funerals are about remembering the loved one who has gone on, but I really show up for the living. I show up for the living. And I didn't know things like that when I came into AA. And I've learned a lot of my social skills, my relationship skills, how to get along in groups, how to be of service here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, grown up and learned how to be a woman in the world here in this program. I have a sobriety date. It is the 30th of December, 2006. It's a date for which I'm really grateful. In addition to being my sobriety date, it is my papa's belly button birthday. And he was an alcoholic in Appalachia over in Eastern Kentucky. And he didn't have the gift of sobriety. And I feel like my sobriety date is kind of a wink and a nudge from him, like, hey, kid, run with this thing. You know, I didn't have that opportunity. He had kidney failure as a result of his drinking. And his second wife, Cynthia, did tell me that when they fussed, he would drive across the river and go over to West Virginia, where they did have an AA meeting. And so he was exposed a little bit to the program and the fellowship. But that he certainly didn't have any sobriety or real program. And so, you know, I want to keep my sobriety for a lot of reasons, but also I feel like it's a little bit of a gift from him. I have a home group. It's called the Beacon Group. We meet in person in the Boston area on Mondays and Wednesdays. Monday nights, we do a line by line big book study. Wednesday nights, we have three speakers. We also meet online Monday through Friday at 12 noon. And you can go to beacongroupaa.com to get the details. We do a step every single day. I don't know about y'all, but I lived in the problem and I had a lot of emotional pain when I got here. And so I really enjoy and celebrate living in the solution, of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we have a speaker read from the book and share on the step of the day for 30 minutes. And because we believe participation is the key to harmony, we then break into small groups and everyone has the opportunity to share on the step. We'd love to have you join us at the Beacon Group Monday through Friday at 11 Central Time. I have a wonderful sponsor. We are three legacy women. Loved hearing y'all mention the three legacies at in the opening program here at the Grace Group. Recovery through practice of the 12 steps, unity through practice of the 12 traditions, and service through practice of the 12 concepts of service. And I've also learned that those traditions and concepts of service apply to my personal life. One of the ways I've experienced them is that in the steps I make peace with myself, the traditions I make peace with others, and in concepts I learn how to be at peace in a world that is often not very peaceful. You know, it's a very turbulent world out there, but I've learned how to stand for something without standing against my fellows. And I've learned in the concepts about leadership and authority and responsibility, all of which was very mixed up in my mind. I didn't know the difference between those three things when I got here. And participation, delegation, and rights, and the minority voice, and you know, the best thing I ever learned about leadership was in Bill's essay on leadership, which is in Concept 9. And so, I want the entire program. I don't want just a third of it. In the 12 steps, or two-thirds of it with the traditions, I want the entire program. So I understand that the suggested guidance for the share is about, you know, my relationship with my higher power. And so I would love to share a little bit about how I am an alcoholic. I meet the requirement for membership here. I have a desire to stop drinking. And I'd like to say welcome to anyone who's new. You never have to be alone again. You know, the first word of the first step is we, and that's been my experience. And then share a little bit about my journey with this and the adventure of a higher power. I will say that when I came in, you know, I was tortured by loneliness, which Bill talks about in the fourth step in the 12 and 12, and how most alcoholics are tortured by loneliness. And so I found it very comforting to read a story from the back of the big book every night when I was going to sleep.
And those stories are very much about how individual alcoholics discovered and cultivated and forged a relationship with a God of their own understanding. And so if anyone's feeling some loneliness or need some comfort, I highly suggest those stories. And I also got a lot of identification out of the stories. You know, it was not my big idea to be an alcoholic when I got here. And, you know, there was, it was suggested that I go to at least 2 literature meetings a week. And it was through reading the literature that I found my identification in the big book. You know, lines like, it is the great obsession of every abnormal drinking that one day she can control and enjoy her drinking. That really got me. And, you know, here are some of the things we tried as it lays out in the book. And, you know, I'm from Kentucky. So I thought, oh, I just need to find a cute signature drink like bourbon, right? Oh, that's, you know, that's snazzy. I'll just drink bourbon. And, in the story, My Bottle, My Resentments and Me, you know, what did I have in common with this guy? He writes at the opening of the story that his beard would have gone down to his belt if he'd had a belt. He was a hobo. But he says, his sponsor said to him, it's not how much you drink, it's what happens when you drink. And I thought, oh crap, that's me. You know, that's me. And so in reading the book, I had all that identification. And so I ultimately conceded to my innermost self that I too was an alcoholic, and that was the first step in my recovery.
You know, we say, and it says in the reading that y'all shared, that we're not allied with any particular faith. And it says in the opening of 12 and 12 that AA's 12 steps are a series of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced as a way of life can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to live usefully and happily whole. And we say in our preamble that we're not allied with any sect or denomination or institution or organization. And so I think before I embark on a discussion of my relationship with a God of my understanding, it's really important to me to emphasize that AA, as it says in step 2 in the 12 and 12, does not demand that I believe anything at all. And that the realm of the spirit, as it says in the agnostics, is roomy and broad. It is all inclusive. It is available to anyone who earnestly seeks. And it also says that, you know, please don't let the God word prejudice you. And don't let these terms, you know, basically turn you off. And that the word God is just kind of a placeholder, you know. And one of the exercises that my sponsor gave me was to write down all the spiritual terms used in the chapter to the agnostic, spirit of the universe, all the different terms that are found there, to write them down, to look them up in the dictionary, get their proper definitions, and then to really reflect on what those words meant to me. You know, because the journey here for me is finding a personal God with whom I can be on my own intimate terms. You know, because it says towards the end of We Agnostics that the fundamental idea of God is inside every man, woman, and child. And that's ultimately the only place I'm going to find a God of my understanding. And so a lot of my emphasis is that this experience has got to be inside of me. You know, so I'm going to tell you a story. I had a marriage for 14 years that in many ways was a very good marriage. You know, it certainly looked good from the outside, and he's a wonderful guy, love and adored him. There were parts of ourselves that were so sweet and tender and fun together. And then there were parts of the relationship that just, you know, obviously didn't work all that great. We chose not to stay married. I was real comfortable in his world, very supportive. I showed up for him, did the deal. He wasn't so comfortable in my world. You know, he didn't feel so secure in my world. And, you know, I decided that I was spiritually dying, you know, that I was spiritually dying. And I worked with my sponsor a lot on this relationship. And she said things like, stay until you can stay, you stay and you be different. I practiced the program. I applied the traditions. And, you know, I had this dream that, I was drowning, you know, that I was drowning. And I you know, was willing to risk my future on a dream that, and that I was willing to let go of what I had, which wasn't a lot, in order to have nothing, with no guarantee that I would ever have something again. Because I knew that I had a strong spiritual life. And so I was willing to let go of the marriage. And doesn't always work out this way. But when I came to my decision, he came to the same decision independently. And so we were concurrent and we were congruent. And the night that I was going to approach him, he actually approached me and he said, "I realize what you've been talking about the past 2 years." So the beautiful way it came together was that we went to the place where we had gotten married and we closed our relationship together and we stood on the place where we had taken our vows and we rewrote our vows as chosen family. And we made a commitment to stay in each other's lives as chosen family. And he has a special place in my heart, and I have a special place in his heart, and he is Scottish, and I'm American, and I told him he was always welcome to come home when he was in America, and he did. He would come back to the house, and we would visit, and then he came home once, and he had this real funny look on his face, and I was like, "Are you getting married?" And he said, "No," and I apologized for my language, and I said, "Are you knocked up?" And he nodded his head, yes. And we had chosen not to have children. This was a real core part of our identity. And he had an unintended pregnancy. And I was so flummoxed and so shocked. And the next thing he said was, "Will you please be the godmother?" And I knew I had one chance to answer and respond from my higher self, from the way that in the future, looking back on that moment, I knew I would have wanted to respond. And I said, "Of course, I'll be the godmother." And I spoke to his deepest fear. And I said, "And you're going to be a wonderful father." So I gave him a big hug, walked out of the room. I was taking my bonus nieces and nephews out for ice cream. But first, I called a program friend, cussed the paint off the wall. And after a couple days of sitting with this, proceeded to come absolutely undone. Like, it rattled me to my very core. You know, we read in How It Works, we have to let go of old ideas. And I had this old idea that I had to let go of, which is that together we had this shared identity and he had moved on to a new kind of identity. And I ended up wet and naked on a bathroom floor in some big anonymous American city in some hotel where I had never been, just so shaken up. And I had my friend Toby from AA on speakerphone, a couple other friends on a conference call talking to me. And Toby said, and he's kind of my go-to when I drop my basket, he said, "You know, Ashley, in these moments, there's no passage from the book. There's no line that you remember that someone said at a meeting. There's not even a step. It is just down to the God of your understanding. It is just down to God and you. And God is either everything or God is nothing. And what is your answer to be? What is your answer to be?" So I was actually in the bathtub when he said that. And I got off the phone and I got out of the bathtub and I stretched myself out on the floor, cold and wet and miserable. And I just completely prostrated myself in this gesture of complete surrender to the God of my understanding. And that's how God has to be in me, like so intimate and so personal and so down to just the two of us. And it worked, you know, it worked. It worked. And I had to get off that floor and get myself dressed and comb my hair and put on my makeup and go out and do this big public event. And there are pictures of me, and you would never know that 45 minutes earlier, I had been a wailing, snot slinging, come undone woman in a bathtub. Because God is inside of me like butter is inside milk. Like God, just like butter is inside milk. So another story about, you know, God in me is, and it's about my dogs. I've got two stories about animals. I was in Scotland actually, and my animals are really important to me, as they are to many people. And I was told by my then husband that one of my dogs had been out protecting his sister, and coyotes were involved. And we weren't sure if the dog, if my dog Buttermilk was going to make it. He'd been pretty severely bitten, and I was just inconsolable and hysterical. And I called my sponsor, and I was so hysterical that I was incomprehensible. And she didn't know if I was laughing or crying. I wasn't making any sense to her at all. And she said, when she finally figured out, deciphered what I was trying to say to her, she said, "Ashley, are you powerless over this situation?" And I said, "I'm completely powerless over the situation." And she said, "Is your emotional life unmanageable by you?" And I said, "My emotional life is completely unmanageable by me." And she said, "Do you believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you a good orderly direction into sound thinking?" And I said, "Well, of course I do." And she said, "What is your decision to be? Can you make a decision right now to turn your situation and your puppy dog over to the God of your understanding?" And I said, "Yes, I can." And she said, "Well, you have to go do that right now." And we got off the phone, and I ran outside to this big, beautiful, thick, oh, 700-year-old tree. And I threw my arms around that tree, and I got on my knees, and I formally took steps 1, 2, and 3, and I turned myself and I turned my dog over to a loving God of my understanding. And I said, "God, this dog is in your hands until I can get back to America." And it took a long time to get back to America. You know, I was far away, and I had to call an airline and book a ticket and spend the night and wait for the plane to take off the next day. And there weren't, you know, cell phones and text communication on airplanes back then. And I didn't have contact, and I didn't know if the dog was going to live or die. And, you know, I had to make a connection in Chicago and all of that. And I just had to suspend. And I was calm, and I did all the things that were in front of me to do. And I got home, and that puppy dog, you know, had wounds on his throat and fang bites all over him. And he tried to bark and wag his little tail when he saw me, and he pulled through. But I was able to do that because I had a higher power in my life to whom I can turn over anything. You know, I can turn over the drink, of course, right? Anytime, anytime that pink champagne comes through the room, and I just turn it over. And then, you know, this other idea that I can reinvent the higher power. I can fire God, right? I can fire God and get a different God, right? Because God can handle my anger. God can handle my mistrust. God can handle my misgivings. God can handle my whatever. I spent a lot of time in Africa, and I was in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is a deeply troubled place right now. There are over 200 armed militia groups operating with impunity. Reported rape has gone up 98% in the past year. There's conflict mineral mining. It's unstable, it's violent, it's dangerous. And I was there, and I was really disturbed. I was really disturbed that morning. I had been with young women who were survivors of multiple gang rapes by armed militia. I was trying to go to sleep, and I was so distressed, and I was inconsolable. And I thought, I'm having a step two dilemma. I'm in step two, and I need to connect with a higher power. And I thought, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous allows me the dignity of a God of my own understanding. And I started to really, you know, construct a higher power, like bigger than Belgian colonialism, bigger than conflict mineral mining, bigger than these armed militias. And it was getting bigger and bigger than geopolitics, and it wasn't working. I mean, it was not working. I was howling. I mean, I was keeping the whole hotel up, thin walls. And I was really forcing the issue, right? And it says in step 11 on the morning pages in 86, 87, 8, we relax and take it easy. And I was not relaxing, and I was not taking it easy. And I have this little envelope that I travel with, where I just put in little pieces of paper and mementos and I opened up this little envelope and out fell a tiny picture of my kitty cat. My mom had taken little scissors and cut out just around the picture, and this little picture of my kitty cat fell out, and it's Percy. And I looked at Percy, and Percy looked back at me, and I remembered that when I go to sleep at night, Percy curls up on the pillow around my head and snuggles in and starts to give me the bath of the century. And then I feel guilty because I have to put Percy out because I try to get some sleep. And when I open the door in the morning, Percy just looks at me and winks and doesn't have a punishing bone in his body. And in that moment, my higher part power came to me. And I realized that God just wanted to curl up on the pillow with me and weep with me and love me in my brokenness and be with my shattered heart and comfort me and hold my hand. And then I didn't need this big, mighty, powerful political God. I needed a God that was appreciated the tenderness of my heart and that would lay there with me and cry. This small, tiny, gentle presence of a higher power. And that I could hold my own hand and just cry. And that God suffered with me. And that God suffered with me. And that worked for me. That worked for me. And so God and I just rocked me together and cried me to sleep. And I woke up and I was calm. I had that good orderly direction. I was able to do the things that were in front of me to do. I took those girls to the market and bought them soap to take baths for which they don't have running water. Bought them school supplies for a school they might not ever go to, but I did what was in front of me to do. So those are some of my step two stories. And, you know, a step three story is, you know, we're offered the opportunity to make a decision because I can make good decisions today, you know. And in concept three, we say right of decision makes effective leadership possible. Right of decision makes effective leadership possible. And in concept one, it talks about how the AA groups have the final responsibility and ultimate authority for AA as a whole. And when we talk about responsibility and authority, the way that applies to me as an individual is that I'm responsible for my own life. And I am the authority in my own life. I don't let other people, and I don't let alcoholism, and I don't let my disease run my life today. So I yoke that with my ability to make good decisions for myself and my step three. And there was a time when I had the opportunity to make a really big decision that was potentially going to have a lot of impact on other people. And, you know, broad social implications, a lot of people were counting on me. And I could have felt like a lot of pressure about that. And, oh, this is so consequential. And what should I do? And get advice and, you know, hear what the lawyers had to say. And, you know, I remembered something I heard at a meeting, you know, sister sponsee said, I've already made the most important decision I'll ever make. I've made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand God. That's an important decision. And so I said, you know, I think when I make a decision, I'm supposed to pray. So I put on my running shoes, laced them up, went out for a beautiful run on Peach Holler Road, and just opened my heart and said, yeah, the most important decision I've ever made is my step three decision. You know, the most important thing in my life is my relationship with my higher power. This big public decision, that's easy. That just falls into place. I'm a woman of integrity. I'm a woman of high values and ideals. I'm a woman of principles, you know, principles above personalities. This one's easy. This one's a no-brainer. And I made that decision and put it in God's hands, and it all worked out the way it was supposed to. It all worked out the way it was supposed to. You know, in step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand God, praying only for knowledge, God's will for me, and the power to carry it out. I really, you know, to have a good step 11, I have to have a good step 10, you know, and I try to practice step 10 throughout the day. And the way my sponsor talks about step 10 is where am I holding God's hand and where have I dropped God's hand? Where have I dropped God's hand? And so I try to remember throughout the day, obviously, the basic questions that are asked in step 10 in the big book, but I also like some of the questions from the 12 and 12 about, I don't have to like everyone, but I should try to love everyone. And the keynotes are courtesy and justice. Can I practice courtesy and justice? And, we have in our 12th concept, the general warranties of the conference. And they talk about in the general warranties of the conference how I should never be personally punitive, how I should never be an incitement to controversy. I should never place myself in unqualified authority over another person. And I should always strive to be democratic in thought and action. And those are actually my favorite step 10 questions, because my higher power is the one who's in unqualified authority over me and everybody else. And it's not my job to punish anybody, and I shouldn't be an incitement to controversy. So I'm playing God if I do those things. And so I just always like to bring that up. And then the step one, the tradition one question from the grapevine is, am I a healing, integrating presence in my group? Because that's about love. It's about love. And if it doesn't speak of love, it doesn't speak of God. It doesn't speak of love, it doesn't speak of God. So with my step 11, I really like to read, starting on page 86, where it says, upon awakening, we consider our plans for the day. Before I begin, I ask God to direct my thinking, asking that it be divorced. So I get divorced every morning from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. And I like to really pause and do that. So I build in a lot of these pauses in the reading. So I stop there and I close my eyes and I do that prayer, higher power, divorce me from selfishness, self-pity, and dishonest motives. And then I consider my plans for the day. And then I bring in that promise, my thought life will be on a much higher plane. It talks about thinking and inspiration like 12 times in those first two paragraphs on step 11. And it says in step 10 that sanity will have returned and I come to rely on it. Like the quality of my thinking, I can trust myself. I'm unconscious in step one. I'm in my disease. I have conscious contact by step 11. I'm higher powered. I've taken this extraordinary journey toward my spiritual awakening and the psychic change in step 12. It's dramatic. And it all kind of hinges on that higher power concept in step two, which I get to invent and reinvent in cooperation with this higher power, who I get to know so intimately. So I really love that step 11 every morning. And I want to jump ahead to where it talks about how, it says we conclude this period of meditation. So that has been my meditation. That is the meditation. And then it goes on and there's this little line that says, we sometimes select and memorize prayers which emphasize the ideals we've been discussing. And I do that. I select and memorize prayers which emphasize the ideals of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in step 11 and 12 and 12, it provides us with a really great prayer with which to start. And, it's the make me an instrument of thy peace prayer. And so I sit and I very slowly go through the words of that prayer and it slows my thoughts down. It slows my breathing down. It slows my mind down. It kind of entrains my mind and my body and my spirit onto these, words that have such a beautiful spiritual charge. And so when I'm sitting with the words, it sounds like this in my head. It goes, make me an instrument of God, peace. And it's just so lovely. And I do that in the morning. I do it every time I lie down and rest during the day. I do it at nighttime. And then, you know, the world has abundantly supplied us with books and, you know, make use of what religious people have to offer, be quick to see where they are right, as the book says. And so I've, you know, found all these wonderful, beautiful, majestic prayers that I've memorized that I supplement the prayer from the prayer of St. Francis with. And then I just want to say how I pray for other people, because step 11 in the 12 and 12 is really clear that even though my motives may be good, I don't know what's best for other people. And so I actually use the words of the step 11 prayer to pray for other people. And I will say, may my mother have knowledge of your will for her. May she have the power to carry that out. And I keep it really clean and really simple. May my dad have knowledge of your will for him, and may he have the power to carry that out. And I do that for the women I sponsor, or I'll just say, may her heart be open to your will, and keep it really simple. I'm just checking the time. I don't have my glasses on. So I want to tell you a story about being in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where I mentioned I spent some time. And we have a research camp there. So we live in the Central African rainforest for a part of the year. And the routine is that I wake up in my little tent, roll off my mattress, my little air mattress, and do one or two recovery readings, you know, get up about 3:20 in the morning, and then have some instant oatmeal, put on the, you know, the jungle wear, have this little head torch, and start walking in the dark through the rainforest, which is very dense, on a very narrow track. It's hardly wider than the width of our feet, to go see these primates. And we follow the primates all day, sort of bushwhacking. And on this particular morning, the 5th of February, 2021, my headlamp was malfunctioning. It was very dim and I couldn't see. So normally there's a little moonlight filtering down through the tree canopy, but there wasn't much moonlight. And so I was really struggling to see where I was walking, and I was trying to keep up with the tracker in front of me and to get some light off of his headlamp. And I went through a tunnel of foliage where it was really dark, and I kind of had to crawl on my hands and knees. And when I came out of that, the tracker was quite a ways ahead of me. And so I broke into a very strong, powerful stride to try to catch up with him. And I was looking ahead. And when I wasn't looking down, I tripped on a tree root and I fell. And as I fell, my leg broke in four places. My foot was paralyzed because I did nerve damage. And it was a catastrophe. It was a catastrophe. And as I was falling, the knowledge rose up in me that it takes 3 days to go to this research camp from a city, and that it was going to take a long time for me to get medical help. But I suppressed that because the knowledge was too devastating and too terrifying. So when I fell, I dragged myself over to a tree, rested my back against it. The tracker came, Maud, who was the research assistant, came, and I immediately went into shock. We were already 2 hours from the research camp. And I proceeded to lay on the rainforest floor with my leg bent like a boomerang while the tracker ran back to camp to wake up my partner to tell him that this catastrophe had struck. And I knew that it was going to take days for me to get help, medical attention. There's nothing there. There's no electricity. There's no water. There's no food. There's certainly no medicine. There's no painkiller. And there's no transportation. We walk in, we walk out. And I knew that this was between my inner resources and me. And the day before I fell, I had just finished reading the book about the spirituality of the 12 steps. It's not a book that's published by AA, so I won't mention the name, but it's a book that supports AA. And it is 12 chapters, a book about the spirituality of each 12 steps. And there's this bonus chapter, a 13th chapter, in which the author says, I don't know why there's this 13th chapter, because there's only 12 steps. But he says, supporting what I've already shared with you, that he believes God suffers with us. And I had read that 13th chapter the day before I fell. And I was lying there, and I knew that I was in a step two situation, and that I needed the God of my understanding to be with me, because that's the only thing that I had that was going to help me survive. I was screaming, I was howling, my back was arching. All I had was a stick to bite on. When Martin, my partner, got there, he had an expired codeine to give me as an attempt at pain management. And of course, that didn't work. He brought the satellite phone with him, which we have for emergencies, but the canopy of the trees was too dense, and so he couldn't make a phone call, so he had to leave me and go back to camp. And eventually a man walked into the forest named Papa Jean, and Papa Jean looked at me, and he had to, with his bare hands, set the bones of my leg, because they couldn't even put me on a piece of fabric to try to lift me, to walk me out of the forest, because my leg was so badly misshapen. And so I just sat with the God of my understanding, and hung on to the image I have of my higher power. I went back to the faith of my childhood and had a very specific image of this deity in mind, and knew that my God was suffering with me. I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought about how I could have no expectations. I couldn't have any expectations about how help would come, when help would come, what that help would look like. I thought about how people sit in meetings on metal chairs and shake when they detox. I thought about the kindness of what my first sponsor told me about how she was taught, when someone came in and they had the DTs or they were shaking, to give them a cup of coffee that was only half full, so that when they shook, the black coffee didn't splash out of the cup and burn their hand. And eventually my Congolese brothers, you know, put me on a piece of fabric and started to carry me out. And I thought, don't show that it hurts me, because I don't want them to feel responsible for causing me pain. And this odyssey lasted for 67 hours. It lasted for 67 hours. And at one point, when I was finally in a village and I was laying in the dirt and I was wretched and I was miserable, someone came up to me and they said, Mama, actually, would you like Latoka? And Latoka is corn mash. It is pure grain alcohol. And they were offering it to me as a painkiller. And as it says in our 10-step promises, I recoiled as if from a hot flame. I reacted sanely and naturally. The problem had been removed. It wasn't an issue. I didn't have to think about it. It was simple. And I simply said, no, thank you. Because I knew I would come to a future meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and share that this program works, that there is nothing a drink will make better, and that God is bigger than alcoholism. And I also knew that people in AA have buried their children sober, that they have had financial catastrophe, that they have buried beloved sponsors, that people have walked through everything sober, and that I could too. But really, it was just the 10th step promises. You know, it wasn't even a deliberation or a debate. I just said, no, thank you. So God was with me that entire experience, because God is in me like butter is in milk. And, you know, I had to get on the back of a motorbike and hold the bones that were loose in my leg with my bare hands for 6 hours. I had to sleep in a mud hut. Eventually, I was on a bush plane. Eventually, I was in a hospital where they didn't have any medical care for me. Eventually, I was medevaced to South Africa. You know, eventually, I was medevaced to America. That was a 22-hour flight. You know, I was in on a stretcher where I couldn't move, you know. And today, my leg is fully healed. I have full range of motion. I walk, I hike. I'm fully recovered. And, you know, I stayed sober through the whole thing and God was with me. God. And I was almost an amputee. When I got to South Africa, they said, your leg has no pulse and we might have to cut it off. And the first thing I thought was, I can be a member of that community. I can be a good amputee. I can be a good amputee. And God showed up in so many ways. The man who came in every morning at 5:30 and took my blood, I wept. He was my higher power with skin on. He moved me so deeply every morning when I saw him. You know, and the women in the Congo just sat in the dirt with me and they would say, I encourage you. I encourage you. I encourage you. The compassion they showed me, which is what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We trudge alongside each other on this road of happy destiny. So I'm so grateful that, you know, AA has given me God and God has given me AA. And I hope that these stories encourage you to deepen your relationship with your higher power as you understand it. And if you don't have a God of your understanding, you absolutely can borrow mine. She is amazing. And thank you so much for the opportunity to share with you a little bit. It means a lot to me. And yeah, I love my God. I love my God, and she loves me. So thank you all so much. I appreciate it.